is Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth. Today's show is going to be talking to one guest, Chuck Cicera, whose name will be well known to many of our listeners because Chuck has been around a long time in Anchorage, all over Alaska, and he's done just about everything. Our listeners are really interested in aviation and really interested in sailing, really interested in doing stuff outdoors in the bush, and Chuck has been there. And he's written a new book, which I've been really enjoying. It's just chock full of his stories, his adventures that he's been involved in. And I highly recommend it. And Chuck's in the studio with me. And so we're just going to be spending the next hour talking about his stories, his life in Alaska, and his advice maybe on what kind of airplane to buy. So my guest today is Chuck Cicera. Thanks for being with me.
Hey, I want to do a commercial.
Okay.
What's the name of the book I wrote?
Oh, yeah.
You forgot that, didn't you?
No. We're going to get to that.
Oh, we are. Okay.
The book is available now, Chuck Cicera's Alaska, Propellers, Politics, and People. And you wrote it yourself, which is like not everybody does. You just sat down and told these stories. And when I first heard about the book, I thought, I've seen some of those before, an old timer has written a book and, you're a good writer.
Thank you. You really
know how to tell a story.
Thank you.
And one of the best parts of the book is in the back, you've got this amazing list of airplanes. And I can't believe any one person has ever flown this many airplanes. How many hours have you been in the air at the controls of a plane?
28,600 hours. And in 160, I thought it was 158, but turned out that someone counted the ones in the book, and it's 160 different models of airplanes.
I would think it would be challenging just to remember that many airplanes.
Well, it's amazing. You know, it's sort of like having a bunch of kids. You kind of remember their names after a while.
Right. Well, one of the things that blew my mind in reading the book is when you started flying in Alaska, you basically had an airplane that was like had as many instruments as a car. You looked out the window to figure out where you were, and you didn't even have like something to tell you if you're the right way up. I mean, it was just a blank instrument panel.
No, I learned to fly while I was in college at UCLA in 1951, and bought a Luscombe, a little two-place Luscombe. And paid $800 for it.
Hired a guy
for about $2 an hour to teach me to fly it. So by the time I got up, 1 year later, when I left there and came up here with my wife, I had about 250 hours total time.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I was just barely limping as a pilot. But once I got up in Alaska, my mother bought an Aranca sedan, which was a big surprise to me. And when I found out about it, I said, what kind of plane did you buy? And she said she didn't know. But she said I was told it was good. And it was a four-place Aranca sedan. And gorgeous. Had zero-time engine, zero-time prop. Brand new fabric on a fuselage. New paint job. New interior. New tires. New brakes. New tail wheel.
Uh-huh.
New everything. Had no radios whatsoever. And
no radio?
No radio. Not anything. Nothing.
Wow.
And so I took that airplane and... Actually, I first time I flew it, I picked it up at Lake Hood, and I only had a seaplane rating at the time, and I had about 400 hours total time. So I picked it up from Jack Peck there at his place on the lake, and they pushed it out of the hangar on skis, and I slid down off onto the snow, and then down onto the ice, and then slid my way to the other end of the lake and turned it around so it faced the tower, and they gave me a green light, and I applied the throttle, and by golly, I love that sound of that sweet running Continental, and by gosh, it lifted into the air, and I got it up to 900 feet, pulled the throttle back, and let down and landed at Merrill Field, slid to a stop in front of the FAA, and went in and said, I need a land plane rating. When the guy said, how much time you got in the airplane? I said, I don't know, 6 or 7 minutes. But I got my rating in it anyway. But anyway, that sedan and I lived together for about 3 years, and I flew over.
Tell me about flying in those days, basically no radio, no instruments. I mean, just like, how do you even do that?
I had charts,
uh-huh.
Okay, and actually flew all over the state, flew down on the chain, flew up in the Arctic, flew down to the southeast without a rocket sedan, without any radios, and just using paper charts.
You ever get lost?
No, not really. Sometimes I wasn't sure where I was till I confirmed it by finding a river or a lake or a mountain that looked uh-huh. familiar or fit the topographical features of the map. But all of us in those days did that. You know, we were all used to flying without radios, and we got around, didn't get lost, and occasionally run into another airplane. And one time I landed on a place and out in the middle of nowhere, up off the Bering Sea. And pretty close to shore, found a place, and I put the plane down. And all of a sudden, here comes a Beechcraft Bonanza. Strange airplane to see up there. He comes in, circles around and lands. Guy gets out, and I said, "Hey, how are you doing? What are you doing here?" And he says, "Oh, just so wondering what you were doing here, you know." Turned out to be Jack Jeffords, a really famous old bush pilot.
Uh-huh.
And we're the only two airplanes for 500 miles in any direction.
I guess so.
I can tell.
So you owned some different air services over time. You had
yeah,
one
I owned,
out in
Bethel? First air taxi I bought I had one in Florida for a while, and that was a short-lived situation. But I had an air taxi in Bethel uh-huh. that I bought from Ray Christensen, and was partners with George Homan in that.
Uh-huh.
And really enjoyed it. I really, really felt good about flying out of the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, because as most folks know, that's an area that's got about the size of Washington, Oregon, and Idaho combined, and it's got 10,000 people scattered in about 60 villages. So everybody there had to fly.
Yeah.
You know, that's the only way you could get around,
right.
Other than using a dog team and in the wintertime, and a skiff if you could get the rivers to connect properly,
mm-hmm.
you know. But aviation was the basis of life in that part of the world.
Well, it seems like you saw opportunities and you kind of jumped into them. I mean, your personality is that just go out and do stuff, which kind of fit the personality of Alaska in those days.
Yeah, it sure did. Yeah, we were pretty much all kind of that way. And I kind of laughingly say I was a Democrat when I was in the legislature, and I was one of the Democrats that was self-employed my whole life.
Uh-huh.
I got up every morning, and if I didn't have something to do, I went out and invented something to do.
Yeah. So tell me how you first got to Alaska. You're a student at UCLA, and for some reason you decided this is where you wanted to come, and you just got on the road, huh?
Well, oddly enough, I grew up in Panama in the Canal Zone. And not oddly, I mean, that's where we mm-hmm. lived. My dad went to work down there. And so I wanted to play football. And I told them that they didn't have football in Panama. So could I go to California by myself, play football? So my dad and mother, being adventurous types, said, "Oh, sure, go ahead."
Boy, it's clear from this book they're adventurous
yeah,
types. Some of this crazy stuff you did.
There was something else.
You go on vacation, you drive around the deserts of Africa.
Yeah.
I mean, this book is so full of crazy stuff you did.
Well, we didn't get hit with the bullets that they were throwing at us.
Yeah.
But in any case, so I went to California to go to school by myself, and I went to this high school, and I was near Santa Monica, and I asked somebody where the closest school was, and he pointed up direction. I walked that way, and it was turned out to be University High School, which is named because it was a training school for UCLA teachers, you know.
Oh, uh-huh.
And so I went to school. I checked in, signed in, said I want to be a student. They said fine.
So you were a kid.
I was a kid.
Basically.
I was 17, yeah. And I went out for the football team right away and started knocking people this way and that way.
Uh-huh.
And I met this little strawberry blonde, who was cute as all heck, and she kind of took one look at me, and I took her on a date, and I arrived at her front doorstep with a bouquet of flowers and asked permission of her mother and father to take her to a dance. And
uh-huh.
They thought, well, this is a, and I was wearing a, you know, a pair of slacks and a proper shirt and everything,
uh-huh.
you know, didn't look like a rag bag, I guess.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, the next day her mother took her to I. Magnin's in Westwood Village and bought her a whole bunch of new dresses because she figured this guy's going to be taking her out a lot. And of course, I did, and she grabbed hold of me and hung on for 60 some odd years. We were 62 years, yeah.
Hmm.
Ann and I were married 58 years.
And she was from a super
wealthy family.
Yeah, so she's from a different background.
She's Hollywood all the way, you know.
Not Alaska Bush material.
When we first got married, she went to work for 20th Century Fox Studios, had a heck of a nice job.
Uh-huh.
And she was secretary of the head of Movie Tone News, executive secretary.
Uh-huh.
So she was the only one in the office. And she would be, you know, escorting Earl Warren around. He was later Supreme Court mm-hmm. justice. And Clark Gable and people like that.
Uh-huh.
And I was working for Rand Corporation, had a top secret clearance, worked for them. So between the two of us, we were making enough money so that... And we started with $100 when we got married, and 3 years later I had my Bachelor of Science degree from UCLA, planning on becoming a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
But somehow
you got sidetracked to go to Alaska.
Well, while I was working at Rand, I talked to somebody about Alaska, and he got me so interested, and I told Ann, well, I'm going to get out of school here the next week. You quit your job, I'm going to quit my job.
Uh-huh.
Let's get in our Volkswagen bus we just bought, brand spanking new little bus, 54, and let's go up there and see what it's like.
Mm-hmm.
So we came up, we drove into Anchorage, and 1 hour and 15 minutes after I got here, I was working for Pacific Northern Airlines.
That was the time to get here because the economy was taking off. There was all kinds of stuff happening, and you describe driving into town and seeing these airplanes everywhere thinking, I'm in heaven.
We drove along by Peggy's Airport Cafe, and we're looking at Merrill Field, and there was, at that time, believe it or not, there were more airplanes there then than there are now.
Yeah.
And it was the fourth busiest general aviation airport in the United States
mm-hmm.
with, I think it was around 275,000 operations a year. And most of those airplanes, by the way, didn't have radios. They were all light gun. Get a green light, go. Red light, stop. Wherever you are in the air, you know. But anyway...
So somebody in the tower just has a light.
Yeah, they have a light gun. And they still have them,
as
a matter of fact. And I looked at that, and I went out to Lake Hood and saw the float planes and went to International and looked around and walked into the first office I saw and said, I just got here. I know how to fly airplanes. I love airplanes. I just got out of college, and I'm ready to go to work. And the guy said, you're hired.
They needed pilots right now, huh?
Not a pilot. No, I worked in dispatch.
Oh, that's right,
I wasn't quite at that level.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you were sending planes that were flying down to Seattle?
We were flying it down to Seattle, competing with Northwest Airlines.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, Anchorage was a nice, quiet little town. Had everybody was sort of, seemed to me like everybody was building their own home, you know.
Right.
There were smokestacks sticking up through the snow all over the place where people lived under in their basement for the first few years. And it was a great, great little opportunity for a guy like me. And I said it was once in a lifetime opportunity.
For sure. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and I'm having a lot of fun today talking to Chuck Cicera, who, as you've heard, is an aviation pioneer and has done so much that we could probably do like a 5-hour show, but we've got 1 hour to talk to Chuck and learn about his experiences. And if you want to learn more, I recommend his book, which is called Chuck Cicera's Alaska Propellers, Politics, and People, and is published here in Anchorage, but it's available around town.
It's available to bookstores in town.
Yeah.
Or through me, which...
or
just call me.
Enough people know you that I'll take care of it. Yeah. So, you got involved in, everybody was doing stuff outdoors, hunting, fishing, doing all kinds of stuff outdoors. And as you said, was from a pretty, pretty cushy lifestyle in LA, but you guys pretty quickly got out and started doing stuff.
Yeah, within a matter of a month or two after arriving here, we found some property out at Big Lake and went out there, and I chopped down 160 trees and built my own house, and Ann was happily building wood fires and that, and chasing around the woods with her own custom-made 30-06 looking for a moose to plug.
Uh-huh.
She liked that. She really liked to eat those moose, so she found out quick how to get them.
in those days, the valley, I mean, there was not much out there.
No, it was pretty quiet. I mean, it was, I think my post office box was box 12.
Uh-huh.
And my driver's license has only got four digits in it.
Did you commute by air to get out there?
Yeah, I just used to. When I worked in Anchorage at first for PNA, mm-hmm. and then I went to work for Al Bramstedt at Channel 2 and KENI Radio,
mm-hmm.
just in the winter time when it was quiet at the lodge, and otherwise I was out flying for a living. Kind of getting my feet wet, so to speak, carrying people around in a little two-place airplane and getting moose and caribou and things.
Just like now when somebody wants to go hunting, they get an air charter and go out.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. You know, but it was pretty, you actually didn't have to go very far to find moose.
Right.
You know, so it was pretty good. In the meantime, I worked in Anchorage, so to keep the lodge alive, I had to work in Anchorage.
Uh-huh.
So I'd commute back and forth, and I'd fly between Big Lake and Anchorage every day. And in those days, the guys in the tower wouldn't have that much traffic coming in early in the morning. And I wanted to be the first one in the office in downtown Anchorage. So I would take off pretty early in the morning and fly in. And the weather was below minimums. In other words, was not mm-hmm. flyable VFR weather. They would leave the lights off. The tower would know I was coming. And they'd be looking through the fog and see if I showed up.
Because you know they do
a red and white airplane. In the meantime, that red and white airplane was heading into Anchorage, and I'm looking for the tower.
So you're just feeling your way in.
Yeah,
huh?
I'd feel my way in. As soon as my wheels would touch the pavement, they would turn on the rotating green light on top of the tower, which meant the field was closed to traffic. But they always waited every morning till I got my wheels on the ground before they did that.
Wow. I mean, small town. Things have really changed, huh?
Yeah.
So tell me, what was your favorite airplane?
You know, I've been asked that hundreds and hundreds of times, and it's difficult to answer because of the variety of airplanes I've flown.
Like you said, some,
it depends
plus,
on what I'm
yeah.
doing with it.
Mm-hmm.
For Super Cub kind of flying, is unbeatable.
Because that's a fast takeoff.
It's short takeoff. Yeah. And then when I think a Cessna 180 is one of the nicest airplanes ever made.
Mm-hmm. That's why those two planes are so popular, right?
Yeah, that's why they're popular. And then when they get up a little bit bigger, like the Cessna 206, mm-hmm. that was a really fabulous airplane. Could do a lot with it. It was a workhorse and tough as a boot. And so, I like Cherokee 6s, which are for the same reason. They were real good, and I like the engines in the Cherokees better. Uh-huh. They were good Lycoming engines. But for cross-country flying, I've had a couple of 250 Comanches, which were built by Piper. And they were really wonderful airplanes. And I've flown everything in the way of Beechcrafts and on and on and on, just about everything you can think of. But they're all about equal. And they're good. And some are slightly better for one thing or another. So
you're not mentioning.
I think I narrowed it down. Yeah. Narrowed it down into twin engine airplanes.
Uh-huh.
I like the Piper Navajos Chieftains. They're really good airplanes.
Those are powerful planes, right?
Well, they're 10 passenger mm-hmm. twin, and I like those. And I flew an Aero Commander twin, which is a high wing twin with tricycle gear on it. And I put the one I had. I put 1,600 hours in it. It's one of the few airplanes I put a lot of hours in that one airplane. So I flew it down to South America, and one time I flew it from headwaters of the Amazon River to Anchorage, Alaska, just hippity hoppity hippity hoppity till I got here.
Wow.
Yeah.
Just for what reason?
Well, I had the plane down. I went down there on a trip.
Oh, you went there and bought it?
I went down there to do some flying in Brazil.
Oh, I see. Wow.
And I ended up saying, the heck with Brazil. I'm going back to Anchorage. So I picked up my dad in Florida, and we kept on coming.
Wow.
And I ended up back at Merrill Field.
What an adventure, huh?
Yeah.
So you're an old, you don't mind saying you're in your mid-80s, so you're an old pilot. I don't know if you're a bold pilot. We all know that saying, there's no old bold pilots.
Well,
But you said talking here about being taught an older pilot when you're a young man, saying, "I'm the winner of the competition of more 180 turns
than anyone else,
and I want you, Chuck, to be number two."
Sort of what happened.
Yeah.
Well, my first airplane was a T-Craft on floats that I bought up here, and that was a little 65-horse thing which you hand-propped it, and it's on 1320 floats. Wonderful airplane, really, except for a Super Cub. It's the only thing it could be in the air. It'll beat everything else in the air. It'll beat a 180 into the air.
With that small engine.
It's a little engine, but a fabulous airplane.
And that's because of the way the wings are designed.
They're just big, long wings and floppy wings, and they're made out of wood, and they kind of jump up and down. I used to grab one wingtip and shake it, and I'd tell people, if you see that shake, I pull down on this end and shake it up like I'm just doing shaking laundry. And if that traveled the length of the wing to the other tip and back,
That
meant everything was safe to fly.
Wow.
But anyway, what happened was Bill Borland, who was the chief pilot for Reeve Airlines, grabbed me one day and said, "Chuck, I'm going to teach you how to stay alive." And he said to me, "Chuck, I have the world's unchallenged record for 180-degree turns."
That's a quote,
Flying the Aleutian Chain for Bob Reeves. He said, I haven't made more 180-degree turns than anybody in the world."
So that means you see something, you don't like the way it looks, you turn around.
Yeah, he said to me, "I want you in second place."
Uh-huh.
I said, I got the message.
I saw that quote in the book, yeah.
So I have made a lot of 180-degree turns. But in the 28,600 hours, I have never hurt anybody flying. I've never wrecked an airplane. I've put two down because of bad weather, and two down because of engine failure, where the engines quit.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the planes I put down that the engines quit was, it's in the book, was a C-46, which is the largest twin-engine cargo plane ever made.
Wow.
It's a big, big plane, twice the size of a DC-3.
Wow.
And I lost the engines, both engines, due to fuel starvation. Not due to anything I had done, but the previous owners who had signed off a ferry permit on it, Evergreen Aviation, had signed off the ferry permit, had failed to clean the strainers on the carburetors, and so they both chucked up with trash, and both engines quit. One quit, and the other one wouldn't pull any power, and I was at about 1,200 feet high when it happened. And I had to figure out quickly, within seconds, how to get it back down on the ground and walk away, which I did. And there's pictures of that airplane sitting in the grass in the book.
Wow. So, you were telling me this story about Borland, and is he the one who did this thing with you where you're taken off from the lake? And tell that story, because that's a pretty amazing story, and you learned a lot from that moment.
Yeah, well, learned to respect airplanes.
Yeah.
So yeah, Bill was watching me take off, or was sitting beside me when I took off. And of course, I had added power, pulled it up on the step. And then, as we did in those days, we rocked it up on one float to get it off quick. And as soon as it looked like it might fly, I pulled hard back on the wheel and kind of jerked it into the air. And when it got up to it, it was pretty steep, climbing pretty steeply right off the water. Bill reached over and shut the engine off. It just had an off-on switch. Not a mixture control, it just off-on switch. He switched the engine off, and I fell straight down and hit the water so hard.
You must have been totally shocked.
Well, I was more than shocked. Almost wet my pants on that one. But anyway, the engine was running rough, and I couldn't figure out what was the matter, so I had
explain why he did that.
To teach me a lesson. I'm getting to that lesson.
Okay.
Give me a chance, I'll tell you.
All right.
So I crawl out on the float and open the cowling up, look down, and the spark plug wires had come off the spark plugs. When it hit the water, the momentum of the wire, the weight of the wires, actually pulled them loose from the spark plugs.
Wow.
And so I had to plug them back on and then hand prop and get it running again. And when I got in the airplane, Bill turned to me and he said, "Did you learn anything from that?" And I said, "I sure as heck did. Treat the plane with respect. Fly it off. Don't be doing jerk water takeoffs."
Uh-huh.
You know, and so Bill taught me a lot.
So you're like, fly it easy.
fly it easy with my fingertips.
Right, right.
Caress it. Don't meet, you know, do what you call like a meat hands, you know, when you're rolling the plane around. But anyway.
Well, that's, I mean, that's a good, I mean, have you, you've probably taught some younger guys some of those
not
lessons.
Not really. One of the things I did was, I used to do check rides for the FAA in the old days, because I was a chief pilot. I'd get these guys and put them in a plane and take off and see if they could fly before we'd sign them on to hire them and stuff like that. But I never was an instructor.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to do it.
Did you employ a lot?
I didn't want the liability of it.
Right.
And I also never hired instructors because I didn't like most of the instructors are low-time pilots. Most of them are low-time pilots looking for hours. They're trying to learn to fly themselves.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So what do you, when you look at other pilots, how do you evaluate them? I mean, because, I mean, we all fly in little planes, and you look, you know, you never really know when you get on board.
Boy, that's a hard question and a way to answer, but my son, who was a mountain climber, would be going off to base camps to go climbing up in the Denali and area and up in the Wrangells and stuff. And I told him early on, I said, just look for a guy with a gray hair.
Yeah.
Somebody's been doing it for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Don't look for a hot shot. Look for somebody who's been there and brought him back alive. So it just takes time to become a pilot. You can't do it overnight.
Especially some out guys here in Alaska,
right? Some guys have really good skills pretty early on of handling the airplane, but staying alive is a different kind of a level. You gotta be willing to make 180-degree turns when it looks like you might be able to get through.
Mm-hmm.
That might be has bit a lot of people right in the butt.
It's that judgment factor, right?
Yeah. When I put a plane down on Chacachamna Lake because of bad weather, the chapter's called Chacachamna Chicken Soup, which is a funny story.
Uh-huh.
And I was in a Cessna 206, and I came over from Bethel. We checked the weather, and the weather seemed to be okay, flyable, you know. But that's a long way. It's 400 miles and stuff. It can happen.
Yeah.
And I got over the Merrill Pass okay and let down on Chacachamna Lake, and then it starts snowing like hell just as I got over it. So I made a 180-degree turn quickly, and by gosh, it was snowing behind me. Now it's in front of me and behind me, in front of me and behind me. I make two 180-degree turns, and I realize that I've got a choice. Put it down or try to climb up back up through Merrill Pass. At that time, there were over 50 airplanes, wreckage of airplanes, sitting on Merrill Pass.
Wow.
And I could think of those people who had to get through there or thought they could, and they're now decorating the pass. So I pulled the throttle back and landed the plane on the lake and slid to a stop. And I didn't hurt the airplane itself, except it knocked off the nose wheel. Not the strut, but just the wheel.
So you landed on ice?
Landed on top of the ice, but had 4 feet of...
Right.
Three or 4 feet of kind of gummy snow.
Mm-hmm.
So I jerked the tires right off the plane.
Wow.
So I slid to a stop on the nose strut and the landing gear leg on the left-hand side, but no wheels on there. And I was there for a week.
And everybody's wondering where the heck you are.
Oh, they're looking. You know, it was on national news and everything. And I was missing. This is right after Nick Begich had disappeared.
Yeah.
And Nick and I had been roommates down in Juneau. And so right away
Nick Begich, and just some people might not know, was Hale Boggs, who was the, I think, majority leader of the United States Congress, and Nick Begich, who was a congressman
from Alaska,
were flying from Anchorage to Juneau and just disappeared without a trace. The plane was never found.
Yeah.
That was 1972, I believe.
Something like that.
Yeah.
So they said, oh, another Alaska politician's dead, you know, lost in the winter. So anyway, I was there for about a week and waited and waited and waited and waited. And finally, you can read the book to find out how they found me. Meantime, when I came into Anchorage after being picked up, some breathless little reporter, some little gal from NBC, came up and stuck a microphone in my face, and she says, what did you do out there? And I said, well, I brushed my teeth twice a day, swept the airplane off so they could see it, and kind of stomped around in the snow some. You know, she said, what did you eat? I said, Chamna chicken soup. Well, what's that? I said, you get a Sunny Jim peanut butter can, and you put some snow in it, and you light up your blowtorch. You get the snow melted down and get it to a hard boil, and imagine you put a chicken in it and drink it quick. And that went out all over the United States. I got Boston Globe, Miami Herald, uh-huh. L.A. Times, and New York Times, the Seattle Post, P.I. Yeah, they went all over. Chicken soup gets them through.
You must have been good and hungry by the time you got back.
Actually, I was a little overweight. Anyway, I needed to lose some.
Well, this is really fun. We're going to go on for the rest of the hour after we take a break. But I'm talking to Chuck Cicera, who's written Alaska, Propellers, Politics, and People. Chuck is an aviation pioneer, and we're going to talk about his sailing adventures as well in the second half. So stick with us as Outdoor Explorer continues.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on KSKA Anchorage. The program repeats next Thursday at 8 p.m. on FM 91.1. Connect with Outdoor Explorer anytime. Download podcasts and see what's coming up on future programs by going to our website at alaskapublic.org.
We're back. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth, and today we are talking about, well, all kinds of stuff from the life of Chuck Cicera. The first half, we were talking about his aviation experiences and all the different airplanes he's flown, but Chuck has done a lot more things as well. Wow, we could do numerous shows, but we're sticking with some of his interesting, funny stories and his observations from a long lifetime in Alaska. His new book is called Chuck Cicera's Alaska, Propellers, Politics, and People, and you can find it around town in the bookstores. Thanks for being with me, Chuck.
Good to be here.
So I asked you a question the first half, and we just got to finish off with this list of airplanes, because you said your favorite airplane, and then anybody who's interested in aviation in Alaska is going to want to look in the back of the book, because Chuck has listed every plane he's flown, over 150 of them. And a lot of them he has very pointed comments about, the ones he loves and the ones he didn't love. And sometimes the negative reviews are more interesting than the positive ones, right?
Right.
So, like, what are some of the ones that you didn't like?
Well, the worst airplane I ever flew, and that, out of 160 different models, was built by Champion Aircraft, which is a really a good little airplane. For some strange reason, the engineers there must have had a bad dream, because they dreamed up an airplane that was a Citabria, imagine this, with a 606 wheel and strut, like you would have on the nose of a tri-champ, but it was sticking through the belly of the airplane, right behind the pilot, sticking straight down, with two wheels in the front and one in the back.
So it was
gear reversed. And when you roll down the runway to lift off, you'd lift off and you felt like you were on a pogo stick running along on one wheel down the middle of the runway.
When
you brought it back to land, you landed on one wheel and went down the runway on one wheel, which was behind you. And then the flop forward on the nose. I said, this is the craziest, dumbest airplane I've ever seen. And it's still on the list as the dumbest airplane I've ever been around.
It got totaled out,
fortunately, for the owner.
Really?
After I flew it, yeah. They wanted me to fly it to see what I thought, and I said, don't go near that thing. But anyway.
Yeah. And there was one other thing that from the first half that I really wanted to touch base on again, because this applies to everybody who does stuff outdoors, and that's how you evaluate risk. And I've actually talked to other pilots about this and other sailors, and we're going to talk more about sailing. One thing is that, like, when you're a beginner, you're pretty cautious, right? And then you get a little bit of skill, And you think, oh well, I made it through that before. Maybe I can push it a little farther. Maybe I can push it. And then it feels like after that, then you start to
get smart again.
Yeah, right?
You start understanding why your father said what he did. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's very very true in aviation. The way that people coming out, particularly out of flight schools, have it in their head that they know everything.
Mm-hmm.
But they're tentative. And where they go and what they do. Then after about 200 hours of flying on their own, and this is we're talking about insurance company statistics.
Right.
At about 200, 250 hours, they think they've got it all figured out, and now they get a little bit crazy.
Mm-hmm.
They get what we call bird blood, and they really do really stupid things.
Mm-hmm.
Then at about 500 hours, they got their head back on, 500 to 1,000.
And that's maybe because they've had a couple of scares.
Yeah, yeah. If they survive that first 1,000 hours, and they'll get smarter as they go. And the more hours you have, the better off you're going to be.
I found that as a boater, that I take fewer risks now that I've been doing it for decades.
Did you say boater or voter?
Boater. Yeah, voter. You never know that the risks you're taking as a voter, right? Yeah, that's what I would love to fix that one. No, on my boat, you know, because it's not as risky as flying, obviously, but there's plenty of weather things and issues you got to think about. I'm more cautious now than I was when I knew less.
Yeah.
And part of that is that you realize just because you've been through something before doesn't mean you should go through it again.
Yeah.
Maybe you were just lucky before.
Yeah. But anyway, my life in boating started very early. I was 6 years old. My dad bought a sailboat in Miami.
Uh-huh.
And the first trip we made was with no engine. 23-foot open sailboat. We sailed it over to the Bahamas, across the Gulf Stream, 100 miles across the Gulf Stream over to Barbados.
The Bahamas.
Yeah, I was trying to think of the name of the island right off the top of my head. But anyway, we went over there and we camped on the beach with a tent and stuff.
Oh, that sounds like heaven.
So that's how I learned to sail, was with those kind of boats.
And it sounds like he really wanted you to learn to sail.
Yeah,
right.
He did. He had been a sailor all his life.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted me to know how. And so we sailed on that small boat. As my life proceeded, I actually bought and sailed 9 sailboats. So I've been across the Atlantic, been to Africa, been to both sides of South America, been down through the Panama Canal, been from northern France all the way to Seward. At one time or another. And I was single-handed from Punta Arenas, Costa Rica to Seward.
Wow.
In a 45-footer. And
tell me about, I mean, you compare sailing and flying.
It's
in the
very
book.
Similar. You know, a lot of pilots fly. The thing that makes a sailboat go forward in a wind is the same thing that keeps an airplane in the air.
Mm-hmm.
It's the airfoil shape to the sails that hold it up. It's the same thing that holds an airplane up in the sky. And so there's very, and a lot of pilots are sailors and vice versa.
And it's kind of some of what you talked about, like having those the soft touch is also true, right? Because if you're a sailor, you balance the rig, really make it, you know.
Well, I don't.
No?
I suppose, yeah. Firm hand on the wheel.
There you go.
You know, I like to talk, diverge here a little bit to talk mm-hmm. about my wife.
Yeah.
Because my wife, who grew up in Hollywood and became a crack shot with a .30-06, also became, over the years, a really wonderful offshore sailor.
Hmm.
She was at ease. People would say to me, "Is she okay going out there in that boat, going across the ocean?" I said, "Oh yeah, she gets sick to the stomach, and she has a heck of a time of it for the first 200 miles. But once we get 200 miles offshore, she relaxes and sails the next 1,500, 2,000 without a problem."
Wow.
But it's that little bit worrying about running into rocks and piling in other boats that bothers her. But she was a consummate offshore sailor. She loved sailing at night by herself. And I can remember her sailing a 40-foot catch. Thing weighed 25,000 pounds. It was 47-foot overall, with a main, a mizzen, a staysail, and a Yankee jib up, nearly 1,000 square feet of sail, out there doing 10 knots in pitch dark with her at the wheel and looking over at her. With the only light that illuminating the area was a little tiny red light on the compass. But she wasn't looking at the compass. She was looking up at the stars she would navigate by. And she was at ease and in control of that boat.
Wow. Yeah, you mentioned that about
wonderful,
her.
She's a wonderful sailor.
So how do you prepare for sailing all the way across the ocean? I mean, is it a lot of...
Well, for one thing that I figured out early on is don't hang around harbors. These people keep working on a boat and washing a boat and waxing a boat and adding more equipment, more equipment, more equipment. And they stay there and hang around. And the first 20 or 30 years they own the boat, they don't go anywhere.
Right.
Then they say, well, when I get ready, I'm going to go. Well, they're never ready, so they never go. So the first thing you got to do is decide, well, I'm going to go.
Get the heck out of there.
Get the heck out of there.
That's kind of the story of your life, isn't
yeah,
it? Like,
yes,
you just
right.
go. You just do it.
Otherwise, you're not going to get anything done.
Yeah.
But, I left France one time in a 45-footer, and it was a French design aluminum boat with a retractable keel and a retractable rudder. It had two rudders in the back, one in front of the other.
Wow.
And so it was a kind of unique boat, French design, and left France to come back to the United States. And we kept checking the weather. Biggest problem I had for that trip was I could not find peanut butter for sale in the grocery stores. I pushed carts up and down getting all kinds of, in France, you know, 18 versions of pâté, but I
right.
couldn't find any peanut butter. I told everybody, I said, I can't go sailing without peanut butter. But
that
anyway,
lasts a long time,
we finally
yeah.
had to give up on that idea and take off. But we waited and waited and waited and waited and waited and waited. Finally, we kept checking the weather with the British radio station. And when we got a break in the weather, I said, let's go. You know, we're going to go. The first stop is 1,600 miles away, so we're going to go as soon as we can get past that breakwater, get out of here. So we took off, and we went out about 125 miles straight out from France, Lorient, France. We've sailed straight out about 125 miles out and made a left-hand turn, which would get us clear of France, Spain, you know, get outside, and took off. And the winds start piping up harder and harder and harder and harder and harder. Finally,
this was just you and Ann? Just you and Ann on board?
No, it was myself and three other guys. The other three guys had never been sailing before.
Oh, no.
And I told them up front, I said, here's the way it works, guys. When I tell you to do something, do it. If you have a question about it, keep it in your mind. And when everything else is handled, and maybe we're standing on dry land, I'll give you your answer. But right when I'm at sea and sailing, don't be standing around waiting for me to explain it to you. Just do what I tell you.
Uh-huh.
So we took off, and of course the wind kept coming up. Wind kept coming up, and this boat was very seaworthy, and with the boards up. It didn't have a tendency to broach, which is to turn sideways and roll over.
Mm.
And the waves got bigger and bigger and bigger. Finally, we were out there doing, we did as much as 13 knots with no sails up at all, just running on our bare poles. And we were sliding down the face of 45-foot waves with this boat. So when they got to shore in the Canary Islands, they were walking around the dock with a gait that was just right out of Melville. You know what I mean? They were sailors, and they were bragging about having done this, you know. And, of course, all the way down there when it was really bad, they would say to me, Captain, how close is land? I said, Portugal's over there about 150 miles off that way. Can't we go over there? Heck no. Go over there, you're going to get killed.
Yeah.
So I dumped him off on the dock in Las Palmas in the Canary Islands. I said, don't leave the boat. It's illegal to leave the boat. Stay with the boat. I got to go clear the papers. So I'm gone from the boat about two and a half hours, getting the papers cleared, the passports and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I come back, and they're all off the boat, walking them down the dock with a swagger.
Yeah.
Right? And they said, guess what, Chuck? And I said, what? Eight people were killed in that storm trying to get into harbors in Portugal. I said, oh, yeah, that's what I told you. Stay away from those harbors.
Yeah.
You got out here in the ocean, we can deal with that.
Is that the hairiest situation you ever had at sea?
Well, it's one of them. I've had boats try to sink out from under me. That gets kind of hairy, but what you do there is figure out how to keep it afloat.
Yeah.
You know? But, no, I've owned 9 sailboats. And like I said, Ann just really got into that right away.
Well, I know you mentioned to me that she had passed away while you were sailing, just the two of you.
We were in Miami, and
this
we were
was, I mean, you were not young people when this happened.
No.
I mean, you were, tell me about a little tiny boat, two older people sailing. It's
well, I know people won't believe this, but we were on a 23-foot boat, but it was a capable little boat. And we were leaving Miami to go to Belize, which is about 1,000 miles, 1,200 miles away.
Just straight shot.
Straight shot to Belize. And
this was, you were in your 70s?
Well, we were in our 70s, both of us. And we were going to take off and go. And we got out there that first night, and she started having problems. She said, I don't feel well. So I turned around, made a 180, came back and dropped the hook and took her to the hospital, found out she'd had a stroke. A stroke had destroyed quite a number of her brain cells. And I asked the doctor, I said, what does this mean? And he said, well, what this means is that brain cells don't reconstitute themselves, and she's going to die. And I said, oh, man, how much time do I have? And he said, maybe 2 years. And 2 years later, almost the day she died, in my arms.
Mm.
I was holding her in my arms, trying to hold her up and squeeze another moment of life into her when she died.
Yeah.
The book is dedicated to her. If you read the dedication of the book, you'll see that I do mention this particular instance. But she was a life's partner in every way, you know.
Mm-hmm. It's very clear from the book. I mean, she's there all over the place, and she just had this can-do attitude that you had. I mean, you're pretty unusual for two people to find each other who are that well matched, I think.
Well, she wasn't an athlete,
mm-hmm.
but she was tough. You know, she had mental toughness, too.
So she just had a stroke while you were sailing the boat out in the middle of the ocean.
Yeah.
That must have been as scary as it could be.
What do? You turn around and come back.
Mm-hmm. Because there's no, you must have some medical skills of some kind to spend this much time.
Yeah, reading the book about my medical skills, there's a chapter in there called Dr. Patch-em-up. That's me. Sewing people up. I was the only person who had been in college, lived out in out near Big Lake.
Mm-hmm.
So naturally, everybody thought I knew how to fix everything. So there's some mighty interesting pseudo-medical practices occurring out there.
Whatever it takes to make things whatever it takes work,
to keep
huh?
the population going.
Yeah.
Yeah, I enjoyed doing it. And in those days, I knew every doctor in Anchorage.
Mm-hmm.
So they'd give me anything I needed, you know, sutures and
can do.
Some drugs that I won't mention, but that I shouldn't be dispensing, but I was able to.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm talking with Chuck Cicera today on the show, and his book is called Alaska, Propellers, Politics, and People. And as you have heard, he's done just about everything. I'm interested, we've talked about when you got here in 54, and you were pretty much able to jump into anything, it sounds like, just sort of by giving it a shot, and a lot of people were doing that. I think Alaska's changed a little bit since then. I wonder if you would sort of talk about like that can-do attitude that you had and that was a big part of your life. Do you think that's still available out there?
Well, I think it is, but I can't see it very often. You know, mm-hmm. most people don't have the opportunity I had. I got to tell you, it was an opportunity, probably a once-in-a-life opportunity. Lifetime opportunity.
All this growth was happening, right?
Well, we were just talking about becoming a state,
mm-hmm.
and I got really excited. I wanted to be part of that, and so as soon as we became a state, went from territorial status into statehood, I ran for the legislature and got elected, and it was a wonderful experience because we were building a brand new state from this rough-hewn territory that we had, and the people that I was associated with in those days were wonderful people. The legislators really liked each other. We loved each other. And Ted Stevens and I had gone to, both of us had gone to UCLA. Both of us had wives named Ann. Both of us had a bunch of kids. And both of us were broke, right? So we had something in common. So he was Republican. I was a Democrat. So we'd switch roles on the floor of this. I'd be the majority leader, and he'd be the minority leader. And then the next time around, it'd be switched roles.
Uh-huh.
But we used to get a kick out of getting everybody.
And it seems like you guys were, problems came along, you'd get down and figure out how to solve them. You weren't so worried about getting reelected.
No, we never gave that a thought. And I don't want to dwell on this, but when I got elected, I got a check for $200 in the mail, and I called Joe Joseph up, and I said, "Joe, what's this $200 check for?" He says, "That's your paycheck." I said, "We get paid to be legislators?" I didn't know that. $200.
Yeah.
But Ted and I, he'd get it and climb in a plane with me, and we'd fly around the state explaining to people in different towns. Like, we'd go to Nome and tell the people in Nome why they had to support bond issues to build ferries.
Right.
You know, GO bonds.
Right, because Bill Lincoln was trying to build the ferry system.
Yeah.
And people
then,
could,
and, yeah. Then Brad Phillips and I, he was president of the Senate, and he and I'd get in my plane, and we'd fly down to Sitka, or down to Ketchikan, and tell those people they had to support bond issues to build schools in the Northwest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because that's the only way we could get our hands on any money. We didn't have oil money. This is before
right.
oil money. So the only way we could do it was GO bonds, and we had everybody in the state had to work together.
And they had to pay for it.
We had to pay for
yeah.
it ourselves. And so it was a different view of things.
Mm-hmm.
But the nice thing about it, I described the legislature in those days as being 60 guys in a boat, 40 in the House, 20 in the Senate, all in a boat. And everyone had an oar. Some oars were longer than others. Some were very short oars, and some were pretty long oars. But we were all rowing in the same direction.
Mm.
So that's the way life was in those days.
Yeah.
And I cherish those moments, and I still admire my partners and that we were former legislators
yeah.
in that time.
You
we still get together from time to time. And we all still kind of have a very fond memories of how we worked together.
You accomplished a heck of a lot.
Yeah.
So aviation has changed over the years, too. I mean, there's obviously more technology.
Well, it has, but one of the bad things is that some of the changes, in my view, have not accomplished what they thought they'd accomplish. This past summer here in Anchorage, reading in the paper, there's been 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 12 accidents,
mm-hmm.
and every one of them in pilot errors.
Yeah,
and then people say, "Gee whiz, they got the electronic gear there, right there. That would show them that there's a mountain there." Oh yeah, how about flying the airplane first and worrying about electronic gear later? These people are doing really stupid things to get killed like that. Some of them are so insanely stupid. I don't want to talk about it on the air. I don't want to get sued by
yeah.
their relatives for saying they're, you know, you go out and. On a sightseeing trip in weather that you can't see anything and run into a mountain? Well, why would you sell somebody a ticket to go sightseeing if you can't see anything?
Yeah.
And why would you continue flying if you can't see anything? So first off, the person that sold the ticket shouldn't have done it.
Mm-hmm.
But then once they did it, the guy that owned the company the ticket was bought on, the one that owned the flying service, should have looked at the weather and said, "I'm sorry, we can't take you today."
Right.
But he lets the pilot get out and get in the airplane. The pilots are so green, they don't have enough chutzpah to tell their boss, "Look, the weather's bad. I don't think we should be flying."
Mm-hmm.
They go out and they do because they think they got to do it.
And the tourist doesn't know the difference.
Tourist doesn't know the difference. He's sitting in the back of the plane. And they fly into a mountain with an airplane with water straight below them. All they do is pull the throttle back and land southeast Alaska.
Yeah.
And go up on the beach and have a picnic till the weather gets better. I really believe in putting the airplane down and walking away from it. I've made that very doggone clear a number of ways.
And that's why you're still here after all these adventures,
yes, and
right?
I've had big arguments with the FAA about that.
Mm-hmm.
Put the airplane down. Who cares if you bend a wing?
Right.
Can fix people, fix them. They like to do that. Cessna sells parts. They like to sell parts. Keep the people alive is my motto.
Well, you've done some flying for in the mountains too. Like your son is a climber,
well,
right?
Yeah, I don't consider myself much of a mountain flyer, but I have done some. I never made a living calling people into the mountains, but my son is a world class mountain climber. And I had the opportunity, because of being in the aviation field, to go up and watch him actually climb up close. And one time, he and two other fellows, Robert Frank and a fellow named Brian Kennard, were on Mount Deborah, and we knew, and they'd been taken up there by a very reliable pilot from Cliff Hudson from Talkeetna, yeah. who has gray hair, or had gray hair, and dropped them off, and they were going to climb a very difficult climb. And Ann and I and Richard, my other son, got in a turbocharged Piper Arrow and flew up to Mount Deborah. And we could see it for an hour before we got there. It was absolutely clear from Anchorage all the way to it. As we closed in on the mountain, we saw three people on this knife edge going up, right on the edge. And we closed in within a couple of hundred feet and went by them. And it was Charlie in the lead, and then the other two guys behind him. And we went by, and I made a circle out. And this second time I came by, very close. I mean, within about 50 feet of him.
Wow.
Or maybe 100. But it was close. Close enough you could see his eyeballs, you know what I mean? Uh-huh. As I went by Charlie, I realized he was standing on a cornice of snow that was sticking out off the top of the ridge. And there was nothing below him. He was just standing on snow like a springboard sticking out away from the rock. And it was 6,000 feet straight down from where he was standing to the next piece of rock. In other words, if it had broken off, he'd have fallen 6,000 feet before he even touched another rock.
You didn't have any way to tell him.
Well, I think he knew, because as I went by him, he waved. And this would be, I'd like to show people this. He had his hand at his hip, and he waved his hand about 6 inches backwards and forwards by his hip. In other words, he didn't even raise his hand over his head and wave it. It was so precarious. So precarious, and I don't want to tell you because it's a little profanity involved. And what my other son, Richard, who was in the back, said when he saw him, his brother hanging out on this, looked like a mattress stuck out on the edge of the mountain.
Wow.
It was unbelievable.
But he made it back, fortunately.
He's continued to make it back, but now he's switching over. He wants to be a sailor.
Well, he's got good footsteps to follow. We're out of time, I'm sorry to say. This has been a really fun conversation, Chuck. Thanks so much for being here.
It was wonderful to be with you.
The book is Chuck Cicera's Alaska, Propellers, Politics, and People. And you'll be able to read about our conversation as well in Alaska Dispatch News, where I'll be writing a column about our conversation. It's Outdoor Explorer. Our producer, Monica Gokey, has sadly left us, but thanks to Monica for her work on the show. Grace Bojean is our production assistant. Be with us next week, and I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.